Okay, John, where are you taking us today?
Yeah, we're heading up now to Derry na Flann. And of course, Derry na Flann, anywhere you see the word Derry, that means that it means there was an oak forest or oak trees around there. So it's probably the oak forest of the Flanns. And the Flanns, well, nobody knows exactly, but tradition holds that there were two priests who were on the monastic site here. So we're walking in along then on the old pathway in along here, the traditional right of way. And we're passing through then the houses here of two people who in the past, these families owned Derry na Flann. And they are the O'Briens and the O'Learys. And as you can see there on our right, all the houses there together, they're formed, you know, which was very common in Ireland, where houses would be very close together and form a little village. And this was the village then of Lurgo. And along this path then, countless generations would have come into the bogs, and they would have come in, they would have cut the turf, cut it by hand then, backbreaking work, and then they would have taken it back out along here. So, you know, you've been a vibrant community along here. But we'll walk in along here now, and then we'll come to a few other echoes from history along the way, and then I'll introduce you to a very good friend of mine.
Yeah, and just before you tell us more about our mystery guest today, Derry na Flann, of course, famous for the discovery of the chalice. And there's a huge story behind that too.
There's a massive, because I think the great thing about that is there's a human interest story, yeah. And people absolutely love that. So in 1980, a chalice was discovered there, and this was probably the second finest piece of ornamentation from the period of Christian art that was discovered in Ireland. From the period, probably the second finest in Europe as well as that. It was a monumental discovery. But it led on, as usual in Ireland, things are never simple, and it led on to problems, and I'll tell you that, and I'll be taking you in here to the site where the place was discovered.
Great, let's go ahead.
Let's
Thanks,
go.
John. Okay, John, we've walked up a little bit now. Where are we now to describe?
Look low there on the far horizon. What do you see?
Oh, I see what looks like what remains of a church.
Yes, indeed. People came to worship there. And that's an echo from the past, maybe 1,500 years ago. And you're now getting your first sight of Derry na Flann. And isn't it in a wonderful place?
It is. So what would this have looked like then at that time? Would this have been all oak forest?
It wouldn't. This would have developed. Ireland, you're generally right, there would be a lot of forest in Ireland, but this would have been bog, actually. And
right.
Of course, in general, now, you will find occasional pieces of oak. That's why you find the bog oak.
Yeah.
But in general, there wouldn't be a forest here. So what you have here then is you're looking at that raised piece of ground. And that was actually an island. And what would have been, initially, that would have been an island in a lake after the last ice age. Ireland was very, very wet when the ice melted, and there were huge amounts of huge lakes all over the country. Mm. And this would have been one. But then gradually, and I talked about this in Upper Church, so we won't do it again, peat formation began in these specific areas. The areas began to dry out and to form peat, and then the Derry na Flann became an island in a peat bog.
Right, okay. And then it became famous, of course, like we were saying, when the chalice, of course, mm-hmm. was found here. What were the circumstances surrounding that discovery?
Well, the circumstances surrounding that discovery were that it was much more unclear, and probably in a lot of ways, if you go back into our heritage in the past, this new revival of heritage, of interest in heritage, is relatively new. There wouldn't have been a lot of interest in old sites. They were things from the past.
Okay.
So there wasn't an awful lot here. So a family called the Webbs went in here, and they got permission, and it was 1980, and there was a newfangled device around called a metal detector, and it was a fad for using it, and people felt, you know, they were going to some site and they would discover a crock of gold. Nobody discovered a crock of gold, nobody discovered anything of much value except for the Webbs. And they came in here in February, and within 20 minutes of being on the site, they got a beep. They
wow.
dug down, and then they found a fairly nondescript looking bowl, Bunn's bowl. And then they just lifted the bowl, and there beneath it was a chalice, there beneath it was a paten and a strainer, and all decorated in gold.
But it wasn't a happy ending, and we might talk about that as well a little bit later. Could you tell us about the guest we're going to meet today?
Well, I'll tell you something. Yes, the guest we're going to meet today is a good friend of mine. And of course, the problem is we haven't, you know, how much time have you got to? So we have to leave out things in his life. But I'll get, I think, the essentials.
Right.
His family hails from Connemara. So, of course, he's a Gael goer. So that's the first thing we have in common. So he went off and he joined the Irish Army, and he spent time, I believe, in the Lebanon, where you know, things were pretty hot and hectic at the time, and sometimes maybe might have been in danger of his life. Came back then, and then was seconded out to work with Gael out in the Congo, but that was really Rwanda. And if our listeners will remember that, I suppose the second greatest Holocaust of the 20th century after Auschwitz and that was what happened out there. And he was there to witness it all, because, he witnessed that. Then he was in Croatia again, is that, and then he completely changed from this to being aide-de-camp to two presidents.
Wow.
Mary McAleese and Michael D. Higgins, as well as that. So he was aide-de-camp to two presidents at a time when there was huge change in Ireland, and in fact the Queen of England came to Ireland, and Barack Obama came to Ireland as well as that.
Wow.
And he was involved in the planning of those. So I almost feel now I should shut up for the rest of the time. But then, you know, having said that, he then went to Holy Cross Abbey one day, like we all have, but instead he walked out of it, and he never stopped walking until 90 something days he arrived in Santiago in Spain. But I let him tell his own story.
Oh, I look forward to it. Let's go ahead and meet him. Michael Walsh, absolutely a pleasure to meet you. And to be honest, I don't know where to start, because John has filled me in on, I'd say, even just the highlights. I'm sure there's a lot more to it. And like I always say, there's definitely a book in you. But can you take me to the beginning of that book? And when did it start for you? How old were you when you joined the army, and what inspired you to join?
Thanks, Alison, and thanks to John for the build-up. It's all downhill from here, I'd say. We hope not, anyway. I'm from Galway. Family are Connemara heritage. The DNA runs totally through it. I joined the Defence Forces in 1976, and I was in the cadet class. I'd previously had, illegally, 3 year service with the FCA.
Right.
So when I joined, I was just on 3 year service. I had a family background in the Defence Forces. My father was a driver in the army in the CAIDCA, the Irish Speaking Battalion in Galway, and he was there. He joined up during the emergency at the start of it, 1939, right all the way up to the early 70s. And subsequently, he left and went working in what was then UCG in the library.
You also served abroad then as well.
Yeah.
Where was the first time you went abroad?
I initially was did a complete cadetship, and I was posted to the 1st Field Artillery Regiment in Ballincollig in Cork.
Right.
So did all my artillery courses, and in 1985 I got a posting to the 57th Battalion UNIFIL, and that was for a 6 month period, summertime, which is great because the weather was fantastic there, and I was posted to South Lebanon.
How old were you at that time?
Oh, I was mid-20s, 26, 27, I think.
Were you excited by that, or were you daunted?
Oh, yeah.
By it?
If you're... Like, this was the career I chose for myself, and I trained for it. And it was the first time you left the country. You were in charge of a group of people. You had to work with them, for them, support them, command. And it was great, yeah. And I was lucky enough that I was posted... At the time, it was during the Israeli withdrawal from Beirut. So there was a lot of activity going on in the area. And I was in a little town called Haris. And I had my 30-odd individuals working with me there. And, you were dealing with the local community. We were manning checkpoints. We were doing nighttime patrols. All the activities that you'd been trained for.
Mm.
And it was fantastic because we had... I was lucky that I had some great experienced NCOs, non-commissioned officers, with me as well. And these were the guys, they're the backbone of what we do.
Yeah.
They have the experience. Some of these guys had actually been in the Congo. Some of them had been in Cyprus. Many of them had been in Lebanon before this. And they were hard-working, honest, trustworthy guys who put in a great shift every day. And my idea with them was to listen to them. But at the end of the day, if you're in charge, you make the decisions.
Michael, I think, is too modest here. The one thing is that when he was out there is that he makes it sound like a good educational holiday and management training. Irish soldiers were dying out there at that stage, you know, so much for the peacekeeping. And it was the place that you really had to keep your wits about you. It was certainly terrifying, I think, at times.
We were quite lucky that during our trip there that we no casualties, serious casualties. We have people who were injured in different incidents that were going on there. But a year later, a lovely friend of mine, Angus Murphy, Lieutenant Angus Murphy, his brother was actually my cadet class. Angus was killed by an improvised explosive device on Hill 880. I think it was Hill 880. And that was exactly about a year later. So it comes home to you, and Angus is buried right beside my parents in Galway. And every time I go up to visit their grave, I see him there, and we say a silent prayer. And he, along with many others, lost their life in Lebanon. So, you know, while I spoke about it lovely being there in the sunshine in the summer, it was, but you know, things happen. That's what, you had to be on your game then all the time, because, you know, all those lads who didn't come home got up every the morning that they died and thought they'd be getting up the following morning again. It just didn't happen for them. So it was a place where tension could rail up in an instant. And it was, for us, it was, as a commander, you had to be switched on to what was going on around the place and never send fellas into danger if it was avoidable.
Yeah.
And so you had to listen to the local community, keep in touch with them, listen to your own commanders. The operations team would brief you on a regular basis as to what was happening. So it was a place that, it was a fantastic learning curve. You know, and as I said to you, I think earlier on, that listen to the guys with you, the experienced fellas. I had some fantastic soldiers with me who could smell trouble coming a mile away because they'd been there before and they'd seen it. And they come and tell you. And the trick was to listen, pass the information on, and be alert. So that's where it came from. So it was when times were good there, they were very good. But in times of tension, you know, it was very tense. And we took as many precautions as we could. You know, we had underground bunkers built for a thing called Groundhog. If there was shelling, if there was attacks on the posts. And really, you had to be just... As a good friend of mine said one day, you got to bring your A game every day.
How long did you serve there? How much time did you spend there?
6 months, six and a half months there.
Okay. What did you take from it?
Without being both, I took great pride in the fact that we all came home together, first of all. I made tremendous friends there, who are still friends to this day, colleagues. And I think it was a great learning curve. Because this is the job you take. This is the job I wanted to be in the army, and the experience there, I think, matured me a lot more. I just took that forward with me afterwards.
And then it brings you later on then to Rwanda, and we now know the horrors that were going on there at that time. But to be there and to witness that firsthand, what was that like?
Well, Rwanda, I suppose, blew up in I think it was the 6th of April in 94, and the genocide commenced. You know, it was Hutus, Tutsis. Predominantly the Tutsis were being slaughtered by the Hutus, and I suppose Hutus who shared some of the government with the Tutsi at the time. And this went on, the horrors of that went on for months, you know.
Can I ask what did you see?
I was watching that on television, and I was at home one day, and what happened was when the Tutsis got their act together and started taking on the Interahamwe, the Hutus, they pushed them west and out of the country. That was their whole thing. So the majority of them were being pushed west into Zaire, or it was Congo before that, Zaire, now DR, Democratic Republic of Congo, to a place called Goma. Goma is right just inside the border. And the Hutu militias pushed their families with them and the Hutu population as cover. And they arrived into a place in the summer of 94, into a place called Goma. And if ever there was a more inhospitable place to set up a refugee camp, it was Goma. It was at the foot of a volcano. The ground was pure rock hard. You couldn't drive a peg into the ground. You couldn't dig a latrine. You couldn't, and as it happened, you couldn't even dig a grave. But we were watching this on television and as it was going on, and John O'Shea of Goal and the people from Concern and Trocar were begging, I would say, to get skilled logistics people out there. They went to government, and the government then looked for volunteers, or through the Department of Defence, volunteers to go out. Now, I had completed a logistics course a few years before, but it was a different form. It was the uniforms and rations and food for a barracks, you know, this type of thing. But So we were lucky that there were two guys with us who had been in Somalia with Goal before, and they became the head of operations out there. So what happened, about 12 of us initially volunteered. We got a lovely send off from Albert Reynolds, and off we went. To this was on a Wednesday, and we were flying into Goma on the following Saturday. We first went to Nairobi, met one or two of the people who had been working in Rwanda. Their stories were horrific. I always remember getting on the plane in Wilson Airport to go into Rwanda, and you're doubting yourself for a few minutes, but that's what you're signed up for. So we got on the plane, got into the airport in Goma, and as we landed, we saw this mass of people, swathes of people on the ground. And as we drove to the base we were in, it was a big old compound house. All along the side of the road were the dead bodies of people who were died from cholera and dysentery, and there was no place to put them. And I suppose that the one thing you noticed was they were wrapped up in bamboo mats, and you'd notice the bulge in some of them. And that in many cases was a child lying with the parents or the mother or father. So that was the start of it, and the smell will never leave me.
And did you have to bury those bodies?
Yeah, part of our teams were involved in the burial of them. We would go around, tried it myself a few times. I found it very, very difficult. Two friends of mine in particular, they really got stuck into this. And there were small pickup trucks, and they would just collect the bodies, take them to places outside of the town, pits in the ground, and just, with very little dignity, I'm unfortunately have to say, got them in, because this went from being humanitarian to sanitation. Because these bodies were dying, decomposing all around us, and they had to clear out because the cholera epidemic was running through the place. I think, I can't put an exact figure on it, they say up to 80,000 people died in the period we were there. I do know one day that lad said to us that we think we buried 3,000 today.
Wow.
And now, along with Gaulle doing it, you had French Foreign Legionnaires, you had Boy Scouts, very adult Boy Scouts, and other agencies, but primarily it was Gaulle put that mission together.
Michael, what do you think now when you see what's going on in Ukraine? I know after Rwanda, we all said, oh, this will never happen again. The world will never allow this to happen again. And we see it happening over and over again.
I have my own view on this. Where there's evil, it'll always come out. And it just takes people to put the little bits together, find the common enemy, find the person that, oh, we're getting nothing because they're getting it all. We see it all over the world. You know, history tells us that. You know, and what's happening in Ukraine at the moment, in my opinion, is just pure evil. You know, I remember, as I think John said, I worked in Jordan and on the Syrian crisis with Dave. And I remember going to the border one day, or one night, and bringing refugees, people fleeing from their home. They had nothing but a small pack on the back, and the look of fear in their eyes, knowing that they were butchers, and that's what they were, Daesh, ISIS, just 2 or 3 kilometres coming after them. That look in their eyes, I'll never forget it. And you know the lovely thing about them was, once we got them across the border, a couple of days later, once they were safe, they had a place to lie down, the first thing they looked for was, could they get their kids in school? That was a common thing along the way. These are, you know, people fleeing terror. It's terrible to see it. We saw it in Africa, we saw it in Europe, we saw it in the Balkans in the 90s, you know. And what for me, the common thing was, it was one group finding an enemy, inventing an enemy in many cases, and then it was a power grab by them. That's the easiest way I can put it.
I totally agree with Michael there. I think, you know, that is the thing by modern society, we are swayed into, I suppose, a false sense of security. But my belief is human psyche doesn't change, and there is there, which are always been through history, an evil gene, and in the right conditions, that will come to the top. And it's just been suppressed up to now, but I think maybe Putin is close to that, but there will be other Hitlers, there will be other Stalins along the way, there will be other Attila the Huns, because it's deep within human nature.
To me, the ingredients are there in places around the world, and it just takes the bad cook to come in and put them together and create situations like that. I remember, like, we were talking about Rwanda. I remember going down one day to bring a small group of kids, our unaccompanied children's place that we ran. They were right in where the Interahamwe, the killers were. And I remember coming out of there, you know, and looking at the eyes of these guys. And these guys had killed hundreds of thousands in the previous months. Slaughtered people, you know, just because of what they perceived as them as being the enemy. Families, mothers, children. And we knew that under the mats they were sitting on, they had the machetes. And, you know, it was a relief just to get out of there, you know, because we had no protection except the hope that we could get these kids out. And that was going on all the time, you know. And to look at these guys, and all these guys that were there back in 94, if they're not dead now, they're still around the place. They formed the militias that have brutalised Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo since, you know. And it's all tied in with mining, diamonds, I can't think of the name of the chemical, or the element for your mobile phone. They are, you know, they are warlords in the area. And unfortunately, it goes on.
Do you think that time in Rwanda changed you?
It had to. I suppose it had to. At the time, when I came home to, I had a very young family at the time. My youngest was, Ben was 11 weeks old when I went there.
Wow.
And my son Kian, who's currently cared for by rehab care, had been diagnosed with autism. So you came home, and I don't think you had time to think about it, because Michelle, my lovely wife, was doing, you know, the hero in my eyes anyway. She was doing the best job of all, taking care of these. I went out there for 6 weeks, to be honest. I forgot to say that to you. I ended up there 6 months.
Wow.
Because the work kept going.
Yeah.
And I had fantastic support from home, from family, from friends, from people in Thurles who supported Michelle, you know, brilliantly, particularly all our neighbours and our families. And because we have no connection with Thurles, we've no family here. So yeah. We need that. And that came from the community around us. And when I came back, there was no time to think about it, because you were back into the fray. I was posted when I came home to Cork, so I was commuting. You know, and all the things that you do in a day's work, you know, trying to help with the homework and the weekends and trying to give a break. Mm-hmm. So,
I imagine that catches up with you eventually. And when did it catch up with you?
I suppose about 20 years later.
Really?
Yeah. I used to always kind of personally feel that in the month of August, I was always in bad form, because memories would come back into your head. I didn't suffer in any way like that, but it was just kind of things would come into your head, or something, you know. I remember one night watching Reeling in the Years, and it went to Rwanda 94, and being totally knocked out by it, because I suppose what
do you
was
feel
it?
Like you were the, just the, brought
the,
back
the,
there.
The smell,
yeah,
it would come back into your head. So in that way, and I spoke one time to a namesake of mine, Dr. Michael Walsh, who since passed. He was a former director of medical services, and I had some lovely conversations with him, and it kind of brought it gave me balance, and I'm better for it. And it was a great help, and it wasn't anything formal. It was just conversations, core out with him, you know. Went down with an arm injury, and through the story we started talking, where were you and what were you doing, and he said, did you ever talk to anyone about it? And I said, no, not really. No, I was lucky out there. There were 12 of us in the group, and there were some Irish nurses and doctors. And every evening we'd sit down and have a chat, and we'd let it go. Mm. Because you knew you had to get up the following morning. I was even talking to two comrades during the week, and that was somebody else in the conversation asked us, you know, were you ever provided with anything, counselling or that, or did you need it? And we said, no, we counsel ourselves.
Yeah.
Because it's you have to do it. ever since the army, in fairness to them, I have to say, they've set up a service, you know, for overseas missions and people. There's formal counselling and there's informal counselling, and that's their PT. It's all there now. Probably could have done with it at the time.